Welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So today I'm very excited as we are joined by Colby Sharma. Colby, how are you?
Doing very well, Jack. Very nice to be with you and good to be with your audience. Zach, very nice to meet you too, and thank you guys for having me on.
No worries, no worries. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. Colby, we kick off the same way every time, so I'm going to ask you a big question, and we'll see where it takes us. Who are you, and what problem do you solve?
So I am a very curious, I like to begin that word with curiosity because I think that is the fount of all learning and all experiential learning for that matter is curiosity. So I'm a very curious, very imaginative, very deep in the sky, but also head on the ground in very many ways as well, with a high attention to detail. And it's been my that way, for a very many years. I've always had that drive to explore, to play. I remember when I was very young, I went through many, many phases. I wanted to be a firefighter. I wanted to be a mountain climber. So to put that into a nutshell, that encapsulates me as an individual. And what problem I seek to solve is the resilience question. I believe we're in a resilience crisis right now, across the working world and across our professional lives as well, especially since the pandemic.
I want to go deeper on that. Obviously, that what you were saying there about like many different things, the curiosity thing, I think is brilliant and is definitely going to align with a lot of the audience. There's a beautiful quote about like whether you say you want to be a greengrocer, whatever you set out to be, you'll become, and that's your punishment. So it feels like you've gone on many different journeys. I guess what happened for you to decide that you want to be on this journey? Why are you now focusing your time on resilience?
Well, I think there's a quote attributed to Carl Rogers, which is, what's most personal is truly what's most universal. And, that's a time-honored quote. But it's true. I had to go through my own, punishment chamber. I had to go through my own adversities, wear my own scars. And that is what I take into the curveball, the underdog, and also into my keynote speeches to help other people. Because I had to help myself once upon a time. And, it brings out that sense of authenticity and that sense of deep passion for the work as well. I couldn't do this job, I'd say, or this career, if it were, if it was just purely an intellectual exercise, that would have been very limiting and not as freeing.
So, Colby, are people born with a set, you are this level of resilience, or is resilience something that you cultivate as a habit?
That's a great question. I think it's like any kind of skill. How are athletes so successful when they're on a Premier League football field? How are the Olympic athletes so successful when they're running as fast as they can 800 meters, though? You have to have some inbuilt level of, let's call it to withstand adversities, absolutely. So there has to be a natural baseline, but then it's all about making resilience and becoming resilient a very much a learned habit and a learned set of beliefs, and most importantly, behaviors. I think resilience is not so much a just you go through adversity and you just bounce back. That's part of it, but it's a whole circle of beliefs and habits and behaviors in a wider sense that will help someone get to that next level.
Amazing. It feels like resilience is an interesting topic because it feels like it can be contextual. So you could be resilient when you're running the London Marathon, but perhaps not resilient when you're facing a long lost parent or someone who's caused you some sort of trauma in the past. So what role does context play in resilience?
I think context is very much part of the equation. Absolutely. We can go into some of the science on, post-traumatic growth and PTSD, but post-traumatic growth being the very much more the positive kind of offshoot of PTSD. Basically, what the science says, and this applies to resilience, is, you go through trauma, for example, at a very micro level. So divorce being the first kind of platform or first level. But if you encourage post-traumatic growth, it's someone's overarching sense of beliefs that are reinculcated again, their overarching sense of maybe it's wonder, maybe it's thirst for knowledge, maybe it's better, capacity to love again. Who knows? But it's a wider sense of transformation to distinguish the micro and the macro.
So those beliefs, Colby, what are some of the beliefs that you hold close to you? And I guess how we've all got different beliefs. How did you come to land upon them?
Well, because it was my adversity that really shaped my beliefs. It was my ability, and I had to go through a period of time where it was very dark. I didn't know what path I was going to really go on, but the unknown unknowns and there's known unknowns. So I had to trust, intuition. I had to trust the people around me. I had to trust, my social network, and I had to take that leap of faith. So what some of the beliefs I really hold dear are, trusting intuition, having that mentorship, the support system, like I share in the curveball, going through unknowns, and really knowing it's okay to feel loss. There's a quote I used to begin the book, sometimes you have to lose something to find everything, because it's in those moments of loss, even though we might not think of it as a loss, but on the other side is a gain if we choose to see it as a gain.
Good. And then there'll be people listening to this that say that's easy for you to say because you've not been through insert whatever here. I guess what would you maybe say to those people?
Well, I would say very candidly, I went through a period of time when I was a teenager where I learned differently. I weren't learned differently from my classmates in the quote unquote, normal school, because society wants to normalize us and it wants to put us on a platform that shows, it's okay to kind of, be with the herd. Don't go beyond the herd. And it, tying into that, there's a book I like called, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, which says if you want to create, go to where your limits are, you have to transcend the limits of the flock. So I had to go through that learning journey. I learned differently. I wasn't sure what path the journey was supposed to specifically be like, but by walking that journey, things got easier. I b met my best friend. I learned about the brain. And neuroplasticity. So I have very much walked the adversity journey.
So I'm interested in the underdog mindset. So if you were to kick us off with what does it mean to have an underdog mindset, where would you start?
Well, I would say there's a couple myths that society has kind of said about the underdog. Kind of, we have to have a rags to riches story to be an underdog. I really don't think that's true. I think we all can be underdogs when we're faced with adversity. It's how we choose to use, what the situation brings to us, especially post-pandemic when there's so much distraction, volatility. There's an empathy gap. There's what I call in my talks a sense of pandemic creep. I would say that, it became easy to operate in the times of the pandemic. Everyone was on the same platform. Everything was default. Society was disengaged. Just you go there, I go there, you go there. Just stay, 6 feet apart. But now we are underdogs because we have to remold ourselves again to a society that's brand new. This is not 2019's playbook. We have to go through this again anew.
Okay. And you said you think we're in a resilience crisis at the moment. What do you think are the causes of that?
Well, we have a sense of burnout, number one. And I think burnout, if I were to share my thoughts on burnout, it is because we have lacked a value system that would connect us with our work, though. That's why we're getting burnt out. If you look at some of the anecdotal research in the Far East Asia, 80, 90% of employees are burnt out. And I would say, you know, we've fallen out of love with our purpose and our work, and that's what's triggering the sense of angst. I would say also, you know, it's people that are being hired in the pandemic that don't know what to do when they're getting into, you know, call it the legacy industries, law, banking, accounting. They're really stuck, and they're wanting to find a sense of values anew that hadn't been shared maybe in the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years of that institution. You know, people want, you know, better balance at work. They want more autonomy. They want better, a sense of freedom, you know, in the work. There have to be some trade-offs, but that is a crisis because, you know, there's a hiring crisis with that, but there's also a generational divide crisis. How does someone relate when they're in the C-suite to someone who is being hired right in the heart of the pandemic? It's a very much, you know, it's a sense of creating bridges instead of barriers.
Colby, I want to talk about reframing. And we're a big fan, obviously working in sales, we're a big fan of mindset and talking about that, but also questions. So you could get 10 different people and they could go through the same exact adversity or crisis or trauma, and each one would respond differently to it. I guess when it comes to reframing, what are some of the most important questions that you can ask yourself to reframe what might be happening to you?
So if I were to talk on a purely organizational level, I would say, you know, how well are you getting to know your employees? And don't just say what the answer that would please HR or whoever hired you. Actually get to know them. What adversity have you actually specifically gone through? Because we've all gone through some sort of adversity, some sort of difficulty in our lives. But when we get to those difficult moments, it's like the trigger to the brain. Aha, I've been through difficulty before. I can do this again. So really sit down with them, build a bridge instead of a barrier, and really get to know them on a very, very deep level, because that will help bring empathy back.
I think about when it comes to like resilience and kind of mindset, I always think, so obviously you're someone that's come through a lot, and I think of it as like a metaphor of like a virtual first aid kit. So what's in your, so if you know that you're going through life and Colby is continuing through life, you probably at some point you're going to go through adversity again. There's going to be hard times, there's going to be dark times, but you're more prepared for it now. I guess what are the things that, you know, if I talk about like the worst day, so for all of us there's probably a day where things could happen that would change the whole scope of your life. What do you have in your virtual first aid kit that prepares you for those hard times if they were to come again?
Yeah, well, I'd say also it's the fact, not only the fact that you've gone through this, number one, but it's the fact that, you know, you have to be able to embrace a wider sense of consciousness though. You know, everyone is going through something. So I'd say when we take from the macro and go inwards again, that helps us become freer. We can choose to be free again and not limited and put into that box. Because I think it's a matter of also shedding the ego. The ego wants us to feel we're going through this alone. No, everyone is going through something. So that's the first kind of reframing. So going macro and going into micro. Number two, having a buddy system, you know, at work, whatever this may be for you. Let's break down the silos. So many workplaces have silos, not just mentally, not just in a productivity sense, but physically as well. So take whatever you can and just disregard any sense of silos. We're not in a world to be boxed in. We've had too much of that, and that's what's led to so many crises, you know, for many, many years. Number three, I would say, you know, just take something meaningful with you to work every single day. Could be something small, could be something big. But if you have something that is a memory, say, of a difficult time, it becomes easier to look at that time and say, I was braver right then. I'm just going to choose to be braver now. One of the things I share is that happened to me personally is I'm a big fan of taking a letter, writing the traumatic situation or something that triggered me or something that happened, and burning it right then and there. You can do this personally, maybe to do it maybe before you go to work, but that triggers the brain to say, wow, it lacks that sense of permanence. That sense of trauma doesn't have that permanent hold on you that you once thought it might have done, and that might have caused your productivity, your performance to decline.
It's really interesting. I love that. So, what do you think the role is then of the stories that we tell ourselves in terms of their relationship with resilience?
I think stories are everything. Stories are everything. You know, your internal dialogue and how you're willing to disregard the ego every day. Think of it as doing, you know, 10 to 15 sets of push-ups to chip away at the strength of the ego, though. Because the minute you walk out the door, get into your car, board the tube, take the train, your ego is going to always be searching to get you into a war. But, you know, as we learned from Freud, we're in perpetual tension between the heroic self and the egoic self, but only one can choose to win the day. And, you know, by learning from our losses, not just our wins, I'd say we've had such a pedestal put on the wins. You know, wins are very important because we want that positive affirmation sense, but so are the losses, though. Really, so are the losses, though, because if we don't know how to lose, how do we really know how to win? Right? You know, someone doesn't get to the Premier League or win an NBA title just by winning. They've had to miss shots. They might have had to come through tough times with teammates. They might have to have some kind of, you know, mental training on the job, called a job, if you will. But losses sow the seeds for the win.
So it sounds like you're saying then that suffering, regardless, is an inevitable part of the process. It has to be embraced.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I sometimes one thing I've been wondering around at the minute. You mentioned a few things that have it got my brain firing. So we were talking about then ego and resilience and the relationship. It's almost like a fine balance between the heroic and the egoic self. Sometimes I wonder if the lexicon that we use, especially in sales, is a bit too bro, a bit too violent, a bit too, you know, like go out and kill it, go out and destroy it, smash that goal, destroy that. And then suddenly that's the lexicon we fall into. And often we're then leaning on the egoic rather than the heroic. Does that make sense as a potential problem?
Yes, oh, absolutely. Well, I used to work in sales myself. I sold actually household knives, which was something very hard to do, actually. Getting someone to come into your house
I
and
bet.
open up a set of knives to you, like, whoa. So, I mean, you know, sales is a very high performing job that relies on quotas. Relies on who are you closing at the end of the month and how much are you bringing in at the end of the month and what's in your pipeline. But can you choose to maybe not so much be more passive in the language, but I'd say refine the language. So you can say something like, you know, instead of killing it or crushing it, say, how can we optimize ourselves in this Q1 or Q2? How can you optimize your sales process or in your sales pipeline? Maybe try stuff like that.
And then sticking on the sales kind of theme, obviously it's interesting that you've, I mean, everybody works in sales, but I think slumps are a big thing that you'll find at like a slump in life of, is it a depression or actually is it a bit of sadness? All of these different things. When you find yourself in a slump, what are the go-tos? What can you do? Like what are the things that you, I love the thing that you said about the letter, but anything else like that, but what gets you out of a slump and what can people be doing to get themselves out?
Positive journaling, you know, I have this saying, and I share this with some of my clients. Write down in a journal, I'm enough for myself in the morning, afternoon, evening, and in the nighttime. And if you do that, if you put that in a journal, maybe do some kind of graph or sketch it out, whatever you do. But just say to yourself, I am enough. And this adversity, this pain, I'm not going to let it have the permanence over me anymore. What I did specifically when I worked in sales, I got everyone together and we went out for dinner. People who were performing at the top, I was performing maybe top three. People who were just way at the bottom and starting out. Let's go for dinner. Let's get on the same page because we're all part of this company. We're all selling very much the same product. We're talking to very much the same people. Some are just a bit more advanced, I'd say, in doing so. But we're all one, you know, e pluribus unum, out of many, one.
So Colby, I've got to ask. So obviously there's so much to take away from these conversations and so much passion. Obviously, I came across you from reading some of your dad's books, and I've read a few bits of his philosophy and things like that. Have you always thought this way? Is this like a learnt behavior? And actually, well, I've always had this because of learnt behavior from my dad. Or was there ever any tension where you went against it and actually you had to come round to this way of thinking? Because obviously, I know that he speaks a lot about journaling and things like that.
You know, I mean, believe it or not, I mean, you know, I've been very natural like this, you know, doing this line of work, this kind of career, but he's been tremendously supportive. Having said that, though, I'm very much a positive person, I'd say, until someone flips the switch or I get in a situation where I'm feeling angst or I'm feeling fear or I don't know what way to go, but generally, I'm a very, you know, even keeled and just very positive.
You mentioned before around this idea of neuroplasticity. So, and I love this. We talk about it all the time, me and Jack. So let's say I've become aware, right? So I've listened to this podcast and I've become aware, you know what? I think there's some work here to do on myself in terms of resilience. I'm open to the idea that I can reprogram and rewire things. What are some simple places to start to make myself more resilient or more aware of the way I'm responding to things?
So there's a book called The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge. Really amazing, amazing book. So when I learned differently, I went to a special school, and that book was the basis of the curriculum. You know, in terms of, you know, writing stuff down, journaling, you know, reframing, any kind of support group, I would say, is also very vital in this process because it's an organic process. You know, there's so many facets that make someone, you know, resilient. You know, maybe trauma excavation. You know, if it's micro trauma, if it's macro trauma, what are the seeds, you know, that are triggering in the present and what is the past motivation, you know, behind that?
And what about things like exposure? So if I'm scared of speaking in front of a group, yes, doing more of that, if I'm scared of being cold, taking an ice bath, what does the role of exposure play?
Yeah, well, I'd say environment is very, very much up there, 100%. You know, you have to chip away at the failures. You have to chip away at things that frighten you, that will help you become more resilient and more impervious to challenge and more impervious to you know, not letting ego come in and hijack your progress.
What's your take, Colby? I feel like we're firing lots and lots of questions at you, but the answer is good. I want to make sure we get the most out of this.
Yes.
What's your take on motivation?
You know, motivation, I'd say, is like the sun, but discipline are the rays. And I'd say, like, habits are the rays that seep downward. So I'd say motivation's like a macro concept, but the suns are rays are the micro concepts. Because, you know, to be motivated, you have to have a sense of discipline. You have to have a sense of purpose. I would say, you know, to create any kind of change, it's discipline, it's desire, discipline, and then action. Because that will have a groundswell of motivation, if that answers your question.
Yeah, so does motivation just come, or can you create motivation?
I would say, you know, environments, people, support groups help yield greater levels of motivation, but, you know, transformation and progress and resilience comes from within. And resilience is a function of, you know, the rays of discipline, of, you know, routines and desire.
Because I'm a big fan of kind of, obviously, we're discipline over motivation. Obviously, discipline will get the work done in the day and motivation will eventually fade. But I feel, and you might tell me that it's wrong, but in order to have motivation, a lot of the time that comes from like a level of pain or kind of adversity. Is that the way you see it, or do you see it completely differently?
I would say motivation comes from, you know, willing to just get out of a rut. I want to be motivated, so, you know, I just can't be on my phone while I should be at the gym. I would say that's the sense of motivation. But if I were to say what helps me become resilient, it's going through trauma excavation, you know, mindful journaling, you know, support groups, environment. I would say it's a deeper level of change. You know, in the curveball, when you talk about routines and rituals, I'd say rituals are the vital, you know, part and parcel of becoming resilient. Because what are rituals? Rituals are brains telling ourselves, you know, it's not so much about doing something new. It's about doing the same thing over and over again that you've learned to do before. So you're just reminding yourself what you already know, but you're doing it in a way that tells the brain, now this is go time. Same way, you know, a football player, you know, does his laces before he takes the penalty shot. That's a ritual.
Amazing. And I suppose people love stories, right? We were talking about stories before. Right. So have you got anything from the individuals or the organizations you've worked with that is a comparative exercise? So here's where they were before, and then through looking at things differently, they're now here. And anything you can tell us that's a quote-unquote success story?
So one of my clients, I'm a massive football fan. I love the story that I shared with them. I said, you know, Chelsea Football Club had a manager, I think it was Roberto Di Matteo, and he took all the players that were from Europe and he had them sing a song in their native language as a means to bond with the team and show them we are all Chelsea Football Club, heavy emphasis on the we. And that helped them win the league and have great success that season. So taking it into an organization, it's about what rituals are you inculcating and what bridges are you making, and not barriers, but what bridges are you making that will help your team win the next quarter, month, and then the year?
That's really interesting. We actually spoke to a company yesterday who were talking about how there almost feels like a divide in terms of the directors, who it's very clear what their goals and motivations are, and then almost the rest of the team who perhaps are there for a 9-to-5 job, and the intrinsic motivation is kind of lost. Is there a way of bridging that gap for businesses that feel like that?
I'd say why we're faced with that, I'd say in 2024, is because we haven't learned how to bridge the generational divide in our workplaces, especially ones with, you know, caught in the legacy industries, law, banking, and finance. But how do we do that? We help by getting everyone on the same page and maybe saying, you know, what really inspires you about this company culture? I want to get to know you and help you find autonomy in your work and a sense of balance in your work. Yes, there has to be a give and a take, but people want something more. If they want to clock out after a 9 to 5, but people who want real and lasting careers, those are the ones, those are the A players, I'd say, in the rough. They want something more from this job. And then make it a calling, though. I want to be inspired to come to work for this company, you know, every single day. I mean, Nike did it brilliantly. You know, having, you know, their mission statements on the wall every single chance they got. Maybe do the same for our companies today. You know, we can do those things, but we have to do it in a way that reflects the dynamics in a 2024 working world. You know, this is not, you know, 2019, we're in a hybrid environment for the vast majority of us. How do we bring a hybrid environment, but we make it feel personal? We make it feel, you know, this is an exceptional place to work instead of where people just deign to work just because they have to be behind a screen.
I love it. It's inspiring, Colby. So you're on a mission to obviously combat this resilience and solve this. So I guess what does the future look like for you when it comes to actually day-to-day and long-term goals of working towards this kind of resilience pandemic?
Yeah, well, I wanted people to know that, you know, number one, it's okay not to be okay. They're not in this alone. You know, people, millennials especially, you know, I think millennials, they bear the brunt of a lot of society's, you know, stigmatizations, but they have the brilliant minds that are yet to be unveiled. So it's really helping them bring confidence back within themselves to bring into the workplace and to show them there is a better way to go about things. And really, that's my mission, for people to know that, you know, resiliency truly begins from within. And sometimes you have to lose something to find everything and to turn adversity into your opportunity.
I love it. I love it, Colby. Before we let you go, I guess if you could only have three books that you could reread for the rest of your life, what would those three books be?
Shel Silverstein, The Giving Tree. Becoming Human, great book. We read that book in high school, and the book is really about, you know, the chapter one you read in grade 9, chapter two you read in grade 10, chapter three in grade 11, chapter four in grade 12. Chapter four in grade 12 is because the fourth chapter is about forgiveness. That was number three. Four, Good to Great. Number five would be Shoe Dog by Phil Knight.
Good. And then is there a quote that you live or die by?
Be the change you want to see in the world. It sounds simple, but by Gandhi, you know, just be the change you want to see in the world, you know, macroly, microly, just keep changing things day by day.
Beautiful. Colby, I love it. I found this conversation very inspiring, and I think the audience will as well. If people want to check you out, they want to work with you, they want to read your books, where can they find you? What should they do?
Yes, absolutely. So if you'd like to read The Curveball, The Underdog, you can find them on amazon.co.uk. They're in all sorts of formats on there. If you want to work with me, send me a direct message on LinkedIn. That is at Colby Sharma, ColbySharma. If you want to follow me, you can do so on Instagram at Colby Sharma Official. And for anything else, any web links, just www.colbysharma.com or just type in Colby Sharma. And I'm available for keynote speeches, masterclasses, coaching, and workshops.
Amazing. Colby, so much for thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you so much for your time, guys. Really appreciate it. Jack, Zach, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Keep on drinking the